It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
In a diversion situation, the social worker or caseworker says to the parent, I'm going to give you two choices. Your child can't safely stay here. Either you identify a relative your child can live with, or we're going to take your child into foster care right now.
Christy Mara, family and child welfare attorney from the Virginia Poverty Law Center, offers the different perspectives about whether kinship diversion, relying on relatives to care for children who cannot safely remain with their parents, is a good or bad practice. And during this week's News You Can Use, we alert you to a fraud advisory about disability services phone calls. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 287, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.wrir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. The Inspector General of the Social Security Administration, or SSA, is warning citizens to be aware of phone calls from unknown people who claim to have information about a citizen's application for disability benefits and offer assistance with the citizen's claim. The Inspector General received a report from a Maryland citizen who recently received several of these phone calls, even though the citizen had not applied for disability benefits. The callers appear to be phishing for personal information, such as Social Security numbers or personal financial information, from unknowing citizens who possibly might have applied for disability benefits and thus might be inclined to provide information to the caller in furtherance of his or her claim. One person who had not applied for disability benefits reported receiving three unsolicited calls from a caller named Scott from a phone number with a 301 area code. There are several variations of this type of phone phishing scam, which could lead to identity theft and/or government benefit theft. The Internal Revenue Service recently warned of similar phone calls from people impersonating IRS agents who request information to process a citizen's tax return. SSA also has received reports of emails that falsely claim to be from SSA in an attempt to obtain your personal information. The email has the subject line, "Verify your personal information with Social Security Administration," and it fraudulently uses a replica of the SSA seal. It asks you to verify your Social Security number to make sure it matches what SSA has on file by clicking a link to submit the Social Security Administration verification form. It also states that the verification is required due to a server upgrading preparation for the coming 2016 tax year, and implies that verifying your Social Security number may lead to higher Social Security benefits. The Inspector General urges you to remain vigilant and protect your personal information. You should never provide your Social Security number, bank account numbers, or other personal information by telephone or over the Internet unless you are extremely confident of the source to which you are providing the information. If you have questions about any communication, phone call, email, letter, or text that claims to be from or have a connection to SSA, report suspicious activities or communications to the Social Security Fraud Hotline at oig.ssa.gov/report or by phone at 1-800-269-0271. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegebright. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the Virginia Poverty Law Center. We're speaking with staff attorney Christy Mara, and we will be talking today about kinship diversion in cases of suspected child abuse and neglect. Welcome back to the show, Christy.
Thank you, Marty. I always enjoy being here with you.
We enjoy having you here. So the first question for our listeners is, what exactly is kinship diversion?
So kinship diversion is a term that was really developed by Child Trends, which is a national child welfare research and policy organization and advocacy organization. And it relates to a practice that is actually used by child protective services workers throughout the country, but is very prevalent here in Virginia. The practice is designed to avoid a foster care placement, which sometimes is appropriate, and I'll get into that later. But what we mean is that a caseworker is asking a parent to identify a relative who can voluntarily take physical custody of a child in order to avoid that child coming into foster care.
Now, what are the circumstances that would cause a child to come into foster care in the first place?
The thing that will really trigger a child coming into foster care is when there is an allegation that a child is being abused or neglected, and a child protective service worker responds to the allegation and makes a determination that if the child is left with the parent, the child would be in imminent danger of severe mental or physical harm. And ultimately, in a foster care case, while the social worker can take that child without a court order, initially, that social worker has to seek a court order. And so no more than 5 business days after that child is removed from the home, a judge will make a determination that the child is in imminent danger if left in his or her current situations. The social services agency has already provided services to try to keep that child safely in the home, and there is no less drastic alternative at this time but to take that child into foster care. So that is the analysis that a court does before a child is actually placed in foster care for more than 5 days.
And so the parent has a right in these situations to contest this in court. How does the parent go about doing that?
That, Marty, is really at the heart of the legal problem with this kinship diversion. There is no clear pathway for a parent to contest a diversion situation, because in a diversion situation, the social worker or caseworker says to the parent, I'm going to give you 2 choices. Your child can't safely stay here. Either you identify a relative your child can live with, or we're going to take your child into foster care right now. And so when the child goes into foster care, of course, the parent has the right to contest that. They get notice of that 5-day hearing I was talking about. They have the right to be represented by an attorney at that hearing. If they can't afford an attorney, and many can't, the court appoints one for them. With these kinship diversion cases, there is no guarantee that a parent will even know that they can go to court to contest this. And even if they did go to court to contest it, there is a chance that a judge would find that it was a voluntary transfer of custody. So it's very complex, and there are no clear rules right now.
So you mentioned that before the Child Protective Services takes a child into emergency custody and eventually has this hearing in 5 days, that the Child Protective Services has to have provided services to the parent who allegedly abused or neglected the child. What are those services that they ought to have provided beforehand?
It's a great question. There are a variety of services that can be and should be provided to parents to try to maintain that child safely in the home. And of course, it depends on the parent's individual needs. Often there is a coach, a parenting coach, who might go into the home one or more afternoons or mornings a week to try to work with the parent on the specific parenting skills he or she might be lacking. There may be a need there. I know I've had cases where there was just horrendous housekeeping to the extent that it was an actual safety concern. So there may be a need to provide some housekeeping services. There may be a need to provide services for the child. If the child has some behavioral issues, the child may need some in-home services. And the list can go on and on. Certainly there are less complex services that are provided. It may be as simple as needing transportation or needing better housing assistance or needing help with utility payment if the danger is that it's the middle of the winter and the heat has been cut off.
So when the Child Protective Services worker is weighing all of this and makes the decision that this child, despite all this, can't remain safely in the home, is there some obligation for that worker to identify a relative who could be a foster care placement?
That's a great question. There is no such legal obligation right now. And in fact, it's my understanding that most Child Protective Services workers, when they facilitate this placement with a relative, do not provide the relative with any information about becoming a foster parent, which I think may run afoul of federal law, to be quite frank. There is a federal law that requires a Child Protective Services worker who takes a child into emergency custody. So when a child comes into foster care, that worker has 30 days to not only identify all possible relatives who could become foster parents or alternative custodians, but also to provide those relatives with information about what it means to become a foster parent, what they would have to do, what benefits that would bring them. None of that happens when the Child Protective Services worker uses this informal kinship diversion practice to place the child with a relative.
And how difficult would it be for a relative who is identified to become a foster parent, and what benefits would they and the child receive?
Let me answer the second half of that first, because I think the first half is a matter of some debate. There is first of all, a subsidy. Once you are an approved foster parent, you would receive a subsidy to help you care for the child. But it goes well beyond that. There are case management services that are provided. There are additional services based on the child's needs. There may be an additional subsidy provided if the child has particularly high needs. So there are many, many services, wraparound services, in-home services that can be provided in addition to that subsidy if the relative becomes an approved foster parent. Now, if those services are not necessary, it's possible that it would be just case management and the subsidy. So it just depends on the situation. To answer the first part of your question, which is, why isn't that happening, I think? Why are relatives not approved? That's a matter of some debate. There has been a belief that has been discussed for a number of years that relatives are often not able to be approved as foster parents because they have criminal records that are identified as barrier crimes, so that they would be precluded from becoming foster parents because either they or some adult living in their home has a criminal record. Virginia has an extremely broad definition of what a barrier crime is. It goes well beyond the federal law. Federal Adam Walsh Act provides that there are certain crimes that are delineated in federal law, and if you, and there's a look back period of 5 years for most crimes, except the most severe. And if you have been convicted of those crimes within the look back period, you can't be an approved foster parent. Virginia's barrier crime statute goes well beyond that. So that's part of it. But I think also there are still some child protective services workers who are not comfortable approving relatives as foster parents.
And is that because there's a perception, right or wrong, that, well, the relative may very well have the same problems as the parent, which is what caused Child Protective mm-hmm. Services to be involved in the first place?
Yes, it's the apple doesn't fall far from the tree idea. And yes, some of us have some concerns that that notion is still out there and that it's affecting the ability to have relatives approved. And I do want to point out, too, that Virginia has the lowest rate in the country of placing children in foster care with relatives who are approved as foster parents. I think we have about 5% of our youth right now who are in foster care with their relatives. The national average is 50%.
And so the other 95% of children who are in foster care, they're essentially with what, non-relative foster parents or group homes or something of that
nature?
They're
mostly with non-relative foster parents. At this point, there should be very few children in group homes.
So it sounds as if this kinship diversion is simply a quicker and cheaper way that Child Protective Services has developed to, quote-unquote, protect children who are in danger due to child abuse or neglect. Is that a fair statement?
It's not an entirely fair statement. I mean, certainly there are some who believe that. And I don't want anyone to think that the Poverty Law Center doesn't see that there can be some real value in a kinship diversion practice if it has proper supports in it. I've talked to a lot of Child Protective Services workers and their supervisors around the state who believe very strongly and with complete sincerity, I think, that diversion is a better system for families because it avoids a third-party decision maker like a judge. It avoids court entirely. And I know many of these the Child Protective Services workers really believe that, and I understand this, families are intimidated by court. If families can work this out without going to court, it will be better. And so there's a philosophy that families know what's best for their children and for themselves. And if we can bring family members and community members around a table, they will make a better decision about how to protect a child and how to keep that child connected to family than if we take those same people into the courtroom. And I think that's the underlying philosophy throughout the state. So there is value in that. And I've just kind of given you the yin and the yang, if you will, of kinship diversion.
Sure. And it sounds as if there are some benefits to doing kinship diversion mm-hmm. that you've just described. Mm-hmm. So lead us through the mechanics of it. Since this is outside of court, are there agreements that are mm-hmm. signed mm-hmm. between Child Protective Services mm-hmm. and the parent, and how does all that work?
Great question. And it works differently in different jurisdictions. There was a study that the State Department of Social Services was directed to do by the General Assembly and they're on kinship diversion. And the results of that study were just produced in a report that was made public in January. And one of the things that the study reported is that there is no common practice for diversion, that different localities are doing this differently. So what I can tell you are some examples of how it might work. I know that at least one locality, many probably do this, but at least one locality reported to me that what they try to do when they identify that a child is at risk is they try to hold what's called a family partnership meeting as soon as possible, sometimes before the child leaves the home, if it's safe, sometimes afterwards. And the idea is that this meeting is when the real discussion about diversion will take place. So it's that model that I talked about just a minute ago, where the parent and the relative and any other supportive community members come to the table with Child Protective Services and their supervisors and try to figure out the best course to take to protect the child. And that can happen hopefully before the child comes out of the home. But it may be that it happens a few days after the child comes out of the home. So you may have a case where a child protective services worker has been providing services to a family for weeks or months and has gotten to the point where the services are not working, and then they will hold one of these meetings to decide what to do next. Or the other extreme is you get a child protective services worker who interviews the child at school, knows the history of the CPS involvement with the family, and goes to the parent's house and says, as I, the example I gave earlier, we need to take your child now. Do you want to find a relative or do you want to place him in foster care? And sometimes in those cases, you have a meeting after the fact.
But if I understand from your answer, there's no requirement that there be any kind of written agreement that sets forth a child's going to be placed with this relative for this period of time, et cetera.
Absolutely no requirement. Now, there will be, if you have one of those meetings I talked about, then there's sort of a record of, a loose record of proceedings. There's a summary of what happens at the meeting, which will include some of the elements, at least where the child will be placed, and that gets signed by all the parties. However, there is no formal agreement or contract.
So how do things like the natural parent's visitation with the child get decided? How do things like what the natural parent has to do to get the child back get decided? And how does the natural parent actually get the child back?
Great questions. And it's all done on a very sort of loose case-by-case basis. Visitation is left up to the parent and whoever the relative caregiver is, with no parameters and no ability to even enforce a parent's right to visitation in those circumstances, assuming the relative doesn't go to court. Often, the Child Protective Services workers will tell the relatives to file custody petitions. And in those cases, if the parent understands what her rights are or his rights are, the parent could go to court and seek particular visitation. But I think most of the time it's just left up to the parties. And then all of the other things you mentioned. What does the parent have to do to get her child back? How does the parent do it? How does she access services for that? Again, that's all very case by case. There are localities that are actually doing follow-up work with the family. If the CPS worker determines that the goal is return home, they may not. But then there are other localities where I don't think they're providing any guidance to the parents. So there's certainly no right to get that guidance or the services that would go along with it if you were in court.
So you gave us the yin and the yang, and there are some benefits and some drawbacks to kinship diversion. What would you do? What would your recommendations be to improve kinship diversion?
I have many. The first thing that is going to happen, and that we worked on this past year in the General Assembly, is that there will be at least some effort to start collecting data on these families to determine whether or not this is even a beneficial practice for children. So there will be a data project piloted in the western region of the state over the next few years. And it remains to be seen whether they will actually start collecting data or just create a process through which then everybody will collect data. But that's going to happen. I would certainly want to make sure from the get-go that the parents and the relatives are provided with information about their rights and information about how to contact the local legal aid or the state bar lawyer referral service. I would certainly want to have that written agreement that you alluded to earlier, although that is problematic too. What I have done is I've been working on a legislative proposal that would allow for the parties to try to reach some kind of voluntary placement agreement, which is what they're doing, they're calling them now, these diversion agreements, but that agreement would only last for 90 days. And that any agreement that put the child out of the home, out of the parent's home, that went longer than 90 days would have to come to court through some sort of new process that would allow a judge to approve this type of arrangement, not as a foster care placement, but not as a pure private custody arrangement either, but something kind of in between. I think I called it facilitated kinship care arrangements, where the court would then get jurisdiction over this after the first 90 days, with the idea that there would be reviews every 6 months, and this would be a temporary one-year arrangement, and if the child could not go home at the end of the year, it would convert to your more traditional custody order. So those are some of my ideas.
Well, those sound like great ideas. Thank you very much. We have been speaking with Christy Marish. She is a staff attorney at the Virginia Poverty Law Center, who concentrates part of her work in family law and child welfare. And we have been talking about kinship diversion, what it is, and how that system could possibly be improved in the future. Thank you so much, Christy.
Thank you, Marty, for having me. I've enjoyed it.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Background checks are used for many purposes, such as credit applications, employment, and housing. But what do you do if there's a mistake? Join us next week when consumer protection attorney Dale Pittman reveals the rules that govern background checks, the pitfalls, and how to correct errors. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wakebright.